Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, it's Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm Cindy Howes, host of the podcast. Before we get into our conversation with Steve Forbert, let's talk about ways that we can stay in touch. You can sign up for our newsletter at our website, basicfolk.com. You can follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. If you'd like to make a contribution, we are a listener-supported podcast. You can do so at our website. If you give at least $5 a month or $60 for the entire year, you'll gain access to our special bonus content, Backstage. And you can find more information on how you can contribute at basicfolk.com/donate. All right, Steve Forbert is not a dramatic person. His stories are fairly straightforward, even though he's lived a pretty incredible life, which began in Meridian, Mississippi as a young musician. In the hometown of Jimmy Rogers, Steve found a great guitar teacher in Virginia Shine Harvey, who claimed she was a relation to the famous singing brakeman, Jimmy Rogers. Ms. Harvey taught Steve music through performance and connected him to other young musicians in the area, who then went on to form a couple of bands. He left his town for New York City in his early 20s, where he pounded the pavement as a singer-songwriter for a couple of years before catching a break. During his climb upwards, Forbert found acceptance in New York's punk scene, especially at the historic CBGB's, where club owner Hilly Crystal gave him a chance and introduced him to his manager. From there, Steve went on to start recording records. His second album, Jackrabbit Slim, gave him his hit Romeo's Tune, which he credits giving him his career and a ticket to the show. He's releasing his latest Moving Through America with more character studies and focuses on life's oddities. It's not easy to get Steve to talk about himself and his reflections, but he's up for giving it a shot. He wrote a memoir in 2018, Big City Cat, My Life in Folk Rock, which sounds like it was a challenge for him to revisit and write about his past, not because it seems like it was filled with mistakes and scandal, but because it was so much about himself. He seems grateful for the opportunity to still have a career and does not take it for granted. He also makes some very hip and hot music references in our conversation, like bringing up rappers Megan Thee Stallion and Jack Harlow. Color me impressed. Steve Forbert is watching the Billboard Hot 100. Let's take a listen to a song from Steve's new album, and then we'll get to our conversation. Here's Fried Oysters from Steve Forbert on Basic Folk. Thank you so much for getting this together. I'm like really pumped to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Okay, let's give it a go.
All right. it's just going to take me a second to set this question up. So it seems to me like going through your history, getting ready for this interview, listening to a lot of interviews, reading a lot of interviews, and hearing the way that you talk about your history versus like the way that it's written about, that you were like not a fantastically dramatic person. Like, I've heard you tell the story about being in Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun video. It seems like very straightforward coming from you. Like, you liked her band. You met. She asked you to be in the video since, you know, Romeo's Tune was such a huge hit. And that's like the end of the story. But like, it seems like that's like a pretty awesome thing to happen to you. And the story could have like gone on with many flourishments and twists and turns. On the other hand, you're like a guy who likes to zoom in on details that seem pretty ordinary and create characters and turn them into songs. So here's the question. How do you see yourself relating to drama or embellishments in your own experience versus like really getting into the drama of the characters you create?
Well, I would say I'm a pretty non-confrontational person. So I'm just trying to, I am not up for a lot of drama. And who needs it?
Yeah.
So I don't see myself as looking for drama in real life.
Yeah.
So what would you say to that?
I would say this is a pretty non-dramatic answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You grew up in Meridian, Mississippi, Jimmy Rogers' hometown, in a like suburban like setting. Your father was a retired Air National Guard colonel, which I haven't read about that experience too much from you. So I'm wondering, like, what impact did his military experience have on your upbringing?
Well, he was not retired. He was running a reconnaissance group for the National Guard. We're talking about jet planes, RF-84s. He was a military person. That was his mentality. He had a lot of responsibility. And they had a squadron of jets, and they had pilots, and those things, I don't know, how fast do they go? 800 miles an hour? Maybe more?
Oh, yeah.
As you might know from the book I put out, he at first said he didn't like the Beatles, and he didn't want any of that. No Beatle records. I couldn't buy any Beatle records. But after a while, he kind of gave up on that. And then very typically, you know, he frowned on my growing my hair out long, like said, you know, English mop tops, the Beatles, and all that. So we went through those normal changes and that kind of friction. The next thing you know, I was just in rock and roll bands and long hair and doing that, and he wasn't really involved in that. That's the way it was. But he was a military guy, and he brought a lot of that control home. And we weren't really on the same wavelength. But it's not unusual for that time, because everybody was at odds with their parents. There was that generation gap.
Yeah.
My dad happened to be in the military. But I kept a low profile on it all. I wanted to pursue music. It makes me think of Jim Morrison, who went completely, you know, extremely dramatic. And his father was a military guy in the Navy. I believe he was an admiral. Mm. But I didn't become real dramatic in my approach to my life and certainly music and a personality music career.
I read that Rolling Stone article from 1980 that was written by the journalist Robert Palmer, where he was talking about, it was a really interesting article. He was talking about your comfortability level with interviews at the time. And he pointed out one of your hesitations in interviews was protecting your privacy, especially your parents' privacy. As you've moved through your life and career in the spotlight, how have you dealt with privacy? Like, how have you held on to a sense of privacy, and what are you more comfortable with now?
Well, I haven't had a real problem with it because of the way things have gone. I didn't rack up a string of hits and become a household name. There you go. So it hasn't been a problem. I've been able to do what I like. And as time goes by, I care less and less about, look, I'm not, as you get older, I know I'm not going to be making records that are in the Billboard Top 100 these days. So that's not so much of a concern anymore. And I've been pretty comfortable with what I do. I play clubs and small theaters, and it's very flexible, and it's not, doesn't involve an entourage, and it doesn't involve three or four tour buses and semi trucks or any of that stuff. So I've been able to do what I like and write songs and fortunately make records, you know, without all that other stuff, you know. Now, if I had to have a lot of money and that was one of my big criteria, that would be a problem. But I don't, you know. I'm perfectly happy driving a Chevy Equinox. It's fine. I don't need a better car. So I don't have a privacy problem. And I derailed that when I elected. Anyway, they wanted, after that Robert Palmer article, they would put me on the cover of Rolling Stone. Things were taking off pretty quick, and I declined. So, you know, there you go. That's probably a big turning point to where I avoided, you know, being under a real glaring spotlight.
Music when you were younger that you were experiencing was in the Baptist church and on the radio, stuff like Peggy Lee and Steve Lawrence. Then you got into the Beatles, despite your father's best efforts to avoid that. But the thing that really did it for you as a young person was the Byrds, and especially their version of Mr. Tambourine Man. And that kind of marked a time when you realized that you could like make that type of sound, like you could do that. How did that change the way you felt about music? And can you describe your relation to music like before you heard the Byrds and after you heard them?
Well, I like the Beatles. I like the Rolling Stones. I like most everything on the radio. I was completely caught up in it. It's just that Mr. Tambourine Man clicked me into, I've got to learn to play the guitar and get it together so I can sing these songs and perform them myself. So that's what Mr. Tambourine Man was like for me. But you see, it was so overtly poetic compared to most of the stuff that was on the radio. It put a rock poet who changed what could be said in pop songs, Bob Dylan, out on the regular AM radio via the Byrds. That's what it was like. And then it just opened up a whole wave of acceptance of this more overtly poetic stuff in pop music. And very quickly after that, you were hearing things by Paul Simon, who was writing excellent songs and going places lyrically that others hadn't. And then the process just went on. You know, soon you were hearing people like Leonard Cohen, who had already released a novel or two and some poetry. And it just that whole lyrical side opened up. A lot of that's because Mr. Tambourine Man became a top record. I'm not sure it was number one, but it probably was.
Yeah. You started on acoustic guitar when you were young, and eventually you were introduced to your first meaningful music teacher, Virginia Shine Harvey, who said she was a cousin or some kind of relation to Jimmy Rogers. And it seems like Miss Harvey was like a seminal influence on you, where she not only taught you guitar in her converted chicken coop, and then also helped organize bands for you, finding other kids to play with. I think it's pretty cool that a woman musician and community organizer had such an early influence on you. What do you think her early impact has meant to your musicality and the way that you approach playing with others?
Well, the thing was is that she was a performance person. She didn't want you to sit there and practice inversions and scales on the guitar. She would just ask what song you wanted to learn. That was the process each week. You'd get the lyrics, which her daughter would write up, and the chords would be over the handwritten lyrics, and that was your thing for the next week to learn that song. So I'd learn that song and then show up next week and play it for her. Those were the lessons. You know, she was not at all into the technical aspect of, you know, a lot of technical guitar playing. She didn't care. It's like if you could play and sing, then she would just listen to you. And it's just that she was so laissez-faire, but she encouraged the performing aspect of it. And I'd already tried all the scales and from a jazz guitar teacher and all that, and I didn't have any enthusiasm for it. So she kept me in the game. That was nice. And then, as you said, she encouraged me to get together with a few other guys and start some little rock and roll bands and garage bands.
She sounds like such a cool lady.
She was. She was very nice. And I don't know what all she had some of the local musicians and country musicians and all that. That converted chicken coop was kind of a little hub for them. Hmm. So she was way into pop music. And for a gal who must have been in her 50s, she was keeping up with stuff like all the teen magazines and all that.
Yeah.
It's a little strange, but she was into it.
You went to New York City when you were 22 years old and started playing on the streets and then at the Hoot Nights and worked your way into opening slots at the folk clubs. However, it seemed like you made some pretty unique inlines in the punk community. Hilly Crystal had you play at CBGB's and invited the punk aficionado Danny Fields, who would then become your manager. So how did you find yourself and your music accepted in the punk world, and where did you see your style living alongside people like the Ramones and the Modern Lovers?
Well, I could relate to Jonathan Richmond and the Modern Lovers. The Ramones was certainly a lot different from anything I was going to be doing.
Yeah.
And I wasn't too concerned with it. I went into CBGB's looking for another place to play. And I knew it was unlikely, but it did work out, and I got to open a few shows for some of the people that were normally on the bill. Talking Heads as a trio, and John Cale, and some groups you may not have heard of, like, I don't know, there was one called the Berlin Airlift that used to come in from Boston. So it was just a place to play, and I was, they were just giving me a shot. And yeah, that's where I met Danny Fields, and it all worked out. But I didn't think I was needed to change or do anything to fit in with that. I just went with what they offered me.
Hmm. I want to hear more about how the style of punk influenced or inspired your music, and maybe how it continues to inspire you.
It's just that I agreed with the punk rock philosophy that a lot of prog rock and particularly technical records and stuff wasn't what I was interested in. I agree with the punk rock thing that some of those groups were over the top and it needed to come back down to earth. So that's the thing. I've never been a punk rock artist. It's not my attitude toward life, you know. Mm-hmm. I just am not inclined to present a lot of anger that other people can do. Other people can do that.
Right.
But it's hard on you. I wouldn't want to do it. It's hard to become a focus of anger and be putting that out because it's going to come back to you. And you, I don't know. It's not for me, as I said when we started talking. I'm not a confrontational. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. you were pounding the pavement for about a year and a half back then before you garnered any interest in your music in New York. But you've talked about how you were like hell-bent on doing music. You said, I wasn't thinking of quitting and going home. It just seemed about right when it finally came together. So can we talk more about your confidence back then? Like, how do you reflect on that, like, quote unquote, like it feels right feeling now? Like, how has your confidence fared over the course of your career?
Well, when you're young, you can focus totally on it. And I did that, and it took a little while, a year and a half, but it went well. And there was always enough coming along that would keep me encouraged. And then I just got started on these decades of writing songs. Like I said, I was able to do this, which I really loved, for all this time, and make a living and be totally involved in something I liked. Confidence level, I'm still at it, putting out a new record. We'll see where it goes from here. Just like a lot of people, I'm not as young as I used to be. I'm dealing with the changes. At this point, it's undeniable that a new thing has come along in pop music. It's undeniable. And so there you go. I'm always asking myself, if I don't really like, shall we say, Jack Harlow. You familiar with him?
No.
Well, he's all the rage, but it's sort of a hip hop thing. I guess it's not unlike what Eminem did.
Okay.
But anyway, but you know, if is it kind of like someone who was into the big band era saying they didn't like the Doors or the Jefferson Airplane? Have to deal with that now. It's a new sort of thing on the radio, and of course I'm aware of all the Americana thing, which offers an alternative to the hip hop element and technical pop radio today. Okay, that's great, but we'll just see how many more records and songs I come up with. We'll just see. But at this point, I've been at it for quite a while, and it can't stay workable forever. You know, finally, another sort of music has come along that I really can't relate to. You know, just like my parents couldn't have related to the psychedelic sounds of Big Brother and the Holding Company, you know. So that's something you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been decades. It's finally really, really, really arrived, you know.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a bit about, like, the concept of genres in music. They say that your music was Americana before the phrase ever existed. And I want to know, like, what is your understanding of why music was split into genres, just your perspective on that? And have you heard that, like, younger musicians these days aim to create genreless music? Like, do you think there's a need for genres at all?
Well, yeah, just for convenience. There's obviously so much difference between, shall we say, Megan Thee Stallion and Jason Isbell. I mean, you're going to have genres because there's a lot that can be done within the terminology of pop music. You know, there's a lot can be done. It's still kind of a 3-minute art form, if you will. But genres don't bother me. I mean, somebody's going to say, well, what is it? Oh, it's Americana. There you go. These terms just get thrown around. It's just for convenience.
Yeah. Your second record from 1979, Jackrabbit Slim, gave us Romeo's Tune, which is interesting to note that you'd actually had it written for the first record, but saved it for the second record. And of the song, you said Romeo's Tune was the song that gave me a career in music. If you can conjure up 6 or 7 hit records, wonderful. But if you got to have one, it gives you a ticket to the show. I'd like to hear your thoughts on Romeo's Tune's popularity, how that's changed your relationship to the song versus your other songs, and what makes you continue to still enjoy playing it at concerts and talking about it?
Well, it just weathers well. It's not something that started to become dated at any point. The lyrics are, I can relate to them very well right now. I'll be singing it every night on the Southern tour that I'm fixing to start tomorrow in Austin, Texas. People still like it. There's still a good reaction to the song. So it's kind of got a life of its own. But like I say, I don't have to force myself to sing it. It's not as if it was, shall we say, smoking in the boys' room or something at the Brownsville station. So it's just a fluid thing. It keeps going along with me, and I keep going along with it. It's okay.
A lot of your stories are recorded in your memoir. You mentioned it earlier, 2018's. The title is Big City Cat, My Life in Folk Rock. And you say you put a lot of your early stories in the book because when you're scuffling, that can get very colorful, is what you said. And you also have other people telling stories to get their points of view in addition to your own writing. So what was it like to revisit your past in memoir form and also to read other people's accounts of your history?
Well, it's something you put yourself into kind of an analytical mode. You start to revisit all that and evaluate some of the choices you made. And so it's not something I'd want to get back into. It's certainly not anytime soon.
Once was enough.
Yeah. It's a bit, getting too much involved in the past is not so good.
Hmm.
But that's what a memoir is, and we had to do it. My friend Terry Boyd helped me write the book. She is an editor by trade, and that helped a lot.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to go back and look at all that. You invariably, unless you're perfect, you're going to see things you wish you'd done differently.
Hmm.
And that's not something I don't want to write another book right away.
Right. Yeah. You moved from New York City to Nashville for a change in scenery in the 80s. So what major differences did you find between the New York and Nashville music crowds? And how were you able to relate to the music and relate to Nashville as a Southerner?
Well, it's just that I was getting a little tired of being in New York City. I'd been there for 9 or so years, and there were things happening in Nashville that I could relate to. Steve Earle calls it the Great Credibility Scare. I'm sure you've heard that. And it was a thing where the singer-songwriters, per se, were getting on country radio. So I wanted to get out of the city, and that attracted me to Nashville. Sure, it was further south, and that's fine. I'm from Mississippi. But it was all about that thing to where a lot of new names were coming along that were getting on the radio, and major labels were signing people like that, and it was of interest to me. And it was of interest for quite a while till that changed.
Mm.
So it was a good scene.
Hmm. I want to talk about the new album now, Moving Through America. It's a series of stories that you collected on a 10-day solo tour through the Midwest in January of 2017. When you were writing this album about places and people you met while touring, and I believe that this album was written during the pandemic, how did writing songs about characters encountered on the road impact your spirits at a time when you're not able to tour?
Well, let me make it clear that the title song is what is written about a 10-day stretch on the road, not the entire album. So that song is just about being out by myself and going through. It started in, I think the first show was Fort Wayne, Indiana, and it went all the way up to Milwaukee and that part of way up there. As far as your question, I was writing these songs all along, and they were, aside from Buffalo Nickel and Fried Oysters, a lot of them are character studies. And that's just that's what my observations have been. Mm-hmm. I haven't been inclined emotionally to write a lot of songs about what's been happening to me. The things that have triggered me have just been looking around and seeing something like their characters struggling with their realities. That's what they are. And that's what these songs are. It's Too Bad Your Super Freak is one, for sure. And there are things in there that are broader, stuff like climate change. I started a song, Please Don't Eat the Daisies. I didn't know what it was all about, but I soon realized it was a song about climate change and global warming. So it became Please Don't Eat the Daisies, Mr. Surf. It's a nostalgic thing back to way back when there was a Doris Day movie. You may remember it called Please Don't Eat the Daisies. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the things that are on the record. I don't know that I'm answering your question. I don't think the pandemic really influenced my songwriting.
I was assuming. I was taking liberties with that question.
Yeah. I don't think it really did. And I didn't write anything about it because it was on the news every night and it was mm-hmm. everywhere, on every newspaper. So there wasn't a lot of need for me to call attention to it, or I didn't have anything else to say about it, or new and different, a different angle. When I wrote the Oil song and started that in the 70s, it wasn't on every headline and every newscast. It wasn't a crisis that was affecting everyone, so I wanted to bring attention to it. It was affecting everyone because spilling oil into the ocean is ongoing, and it is affecting everyone. But I had something to contribute to that issue, but I didn't spend the pandemic analyzing that situation in song.
That's interesting, though, to hear your perspective about writing, because a lot of artists now are like, this is the album I wrote during the pandemic. Here are my feelings about what happened during the pandemic. So I appreciate you sharing that. In listening to you talk about what kind of grabs you in your writing, could you expand on your eye for detail in these characters? Like, when you're walking through the world collecting ideas for inspirations, can you explain what it's like for you and how you're noticing details that wouldn't normally stand out to a non-artist?
I really don't know. I really don't know what people think. I don't know what they're noticing. I really don't know. When I listen to pop radio today and I see that a song like, shall we say, the record of the year last year, WAP, Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion is the song of the year. I don't know. Is that more of a song or is it a video or what? I don't know what people are thinking. I just know that a phrase like, if I see somebody standing outside the hospital smoking a cigarette, it strikes me as ironic. Or when I take a look at a Buffalo Nickel, it just kind of goes through my mind, this is strange. Mm-hmm. You have a Buffalo Nickel, you have a buffalo on one side and a profile of a Native American on the other, and Those two groups didn't fare too well with our westward expansion. Mm-hmm. These are just the kind of things that get me going now, is paradoxes. But it's been true. I've felt that way for a long time, but that's the kind of thing I see around. Cindy, I don't know what other people are thinking, so I can't say, well, a songwriter thinks this, whereas so-and-so, a mechanic at the... Pep Boys is thinking this. I have no idea. I'm just going with inspiration.
for you at this point, what are the realities of touring at this point of your career, like pandemic aside, but also like that break must have had some kind of impact. Like for you, when you're touring, you must look for certain creature comforts, and those have possibly changed over the years.
Well, I've always kept it really simple. Ever since I was not on the major label trip, and as I recall, that kind of ended in 1992, really. I made a record for Geffen, and they put it out that year called The American in Me. Since then, I've just, if you want to stay in the game, as we said when we started this conversation, I don't have that glaring household name visibility. So, okay, I'm not playing the big places, and I'm glad, And so I'm keeping the cost down and doing it economically. It's not going to change much for me. There's not really anything I'm giving up. I don't want the touring to lose money, but I'm just trying to keep the cost down. And there you go. Just make sure it's not an economic disaster to be out there. especially this trip to England.
Yeah.
Because that's coming up in June, and I'm taking guitarist George Naha, who's in my band, with me. Even that is something we have to manage the costs on.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. You said when asked whether you identify as a singer, writer, producer, you said, "I'm a songwriter mostly. Most people who write their own material are able to sing it. You can sing the song and have enough of a voice to sing it, and having a voice to deliver the song will encourage you to write." Your singing voice is incredibly unique and honestly pretty irresistible. Someone described it as almost whispering at times, but with a sure command of texture and nuance and a high sense of drama, Steve.
Yeah, but that's the singing voice, yes. Okay, maybe that's true.
Yeah, so what's been your relationship to your singing voice, and how do you value it, especially in relation to your writing?
I would just say, in general, that same thing that you just said. I wasn't going to go out and struggle to be a recording artist just singing songs that publishers presented to me, ever. So you get into this thing, singer-songwriter, and it kind of implies that you may not be, shall we say, Harry Nilsson as a vocalist, as a singer, but you're going to be a recording artist anyway, you know, so there you go.
You and I did a guest DJ set a while ago, but it really got me into your Instagram feed. And I would tell people, like, Steve Forbert has this pretty fun Instagram feed where he's just, like, posting pictures of fire hydrants and carousel ponies. And in getting ready for this interview, I found out back in 2011 that you had an exhibit at an art gallery in Nashville where they displayed pictures that you took using a 2005 cell phone, an LG phone, called Highway of Sight, pictures that you took on the road. You know, scrolling back through your Instagram, you do have a lot of similar pictures, like chairs, signs, parking meters, old cars, other kind of funky Americana things. I really, really enjoyed those pictures and the random captions of these photos. And I'd like to hear more about these pictures, what you liked about taking those pictures, particularly on your Instagram feed, posting them, the reactions you'd get. And also, this is like a second question to that, but how do the subjects of your photos relate to the subjects of your songs?
Well, the second part, I think the photos definitely relate to the songs. I see them as very, very much of a piece. They're the same outlook. It's just focusing on the everyday and looking at it literally from a different angle, maybe with the photographs, and just trying to say, oh, this is perhaps interesting, or this is beautiful. And it's just something I got into, but I never wanted to get an expensive camera. as time went by, I actually liked the LG phone best. There was not much detail, but the colors were exaggerated. And I liked it because it had a little bit of that hype to it. But I couldn't hang on to that clamshell phone for long because, you know, we've all had to move into the smartphone thing. There are a few diehards out there, but they're difficult to work with, aren't they?
Yeah. My dad's got a flip phone.
Yeah. So I've had to move into, I'm not carrying around an old clamshell anymore. I'm carrying a smartphone, and I still shoot several pictures a day. You know, and some of them go up on in Instagram. But it's really just fun to see something that makes a humorous impression on you, or ironic or colorful, and if you will, capture it. So it's a nice thing. It's an artistic sensibility, and it's very related to what the songs say.
Yeah, I would say, as a representative of all of your fans on Instagram, to please keep it up. It's been a while since you've been doing it, but maybe back on this tour, you can get back to posting weird things that you find in parking garages, because I think that's what the people want, Steve.
All right, Cindy, I'll take your word. I'll try.
Okay, great. So before I let you go, will you do the lightning round with me?
I reckon.
Okay, sure. Here we go. What is the first song you learned on the guitar?
Quite possibly 500 Miles folk song.
Do you like dogs or cats or something else?
Well, I have two dogs here with me now, but I love cats. I don't dislike cats, but dogs are perfect. You know, dogs are just, they're this creature that they forgive us, you know, and where the hell have you been all day? You know, they're not going to give you a hard time. They're glad to see you. They're so forgiving. You just got to love dogs. They're perfect for us. They can live in the home. They understand they got to go outside for the restroom. And they're very workable, you know, and
I love that description.
And there you go. I wrote a song in tribute to our best friend. You might say, cats are our friend, but dogs are really our best friend.
Yeah.
And so there's a song on the album. What's a dog think is happening when the fire truck blazes by? What do they make of that? It's random. There's no pattern. And what the hell is it? You know, these two dogs here with me now, they bark at that. You know, the siren bothers their ears, I suppose, and they'll howl.
Yeah. Next question. Who is your first celebrity crush?
Celebrity crush. I don't know that I've ever really had one. I don't know. I don't know. I found a Genevieve Bujold attractive in the movie King of Hearts, but I don't know. That was later. I don't know. As a kid, I guess you mean. I can't remember.
What was the first album you bought with your own money?
Probably High Tide and Green Grass, the Rolling Stones.
Nice. Ah, well, this next question is appropriate. The Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
I just don't see why you would want to, you know, eliminate one or the other.
The question?
Yeah, I refuse the question. I mean, why would you want to, if you're a Beatle freak, why would you want to eliminate the Rolling Stones? You know, a record like Paint It Black is staggering. And it was so weird to hear a line like a newborn baby, it just happens every day. So, you know, that was pretty cynical for its time. I believe that was Paint It Black, might have been 66, 65.
You're right. That's in Paint It Black.
Yeah. So, you've got to have them both.
Okay. All right. Here's one more question. Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Well, I really think that I went to Rome a few years ago with my girlfriend Diane. I liked that a lot. I liked Rome better than the famous Paris, France. Well, Rome is just funkier. It's just funkier, yeah. And it just seemed more—I don't know—it more tangible to me. I like Rome a lot.
That's cool. Good answer. Well, Steve, thank you so much for talking to me and taking so much time. And I really enjoyed this interview. So thanks again. And congrats on the new album.
Well, thanks a lot. And I hope you can cut this up into something that flows good and fast and and people enjoy it. So thank you, Cindy.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by me, Cindy Howes. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find us there, wherever you get podcasts. You can also search for us on the SiriusXM app. Just open it up and search for Basic Folk. Or you can find us on our website, basicfolk.com. Okay, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.